Good morning. The Senate Judiciary Committee meeting is called to order. Today is Monday, August 30th, 2021. The time is 10:30 a.m. We're meeting in State Capitol Room number 205. Senators in attendance are Senator Hughes, Senator Myers, Senator Keel, and myself as Chair, Senator Holland. I do believe Senator Schauer is attending electronically. We'll confirm with him that he's out there in just a second. I know, just to make sure we got his audio. Senator Schauer, can you hear me?
Senator Holland, I am on. Thank you very much. I will correct you. It's actually 3:30 in the morning, at least where I am.
Thank you for your attendance. Good morning. We do have a quorum to conduct business, but we don't have any official business plan today. Thank you to Carrie, our recording secretary, and Nate, our moderator for today. And as a reminder, please silence your cell phones. I now bring Senate Bill 53 back before the committee for a fourth hearing. We're joined today by Milan Reitfeld, a consultant for the governor's office and a global expert in endowment funds. I believe this would be a very valuable presentation on sovereign wealth funds and the Alaska Permanent Fund. I appreciate his attendance. He, too, is from somewhere else on the earth. And Mr. Reitfeld, thank you for attending. Please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Can you hear me clearly?
I hear you very well.
Okay. I would like to just share, I think, from my side, my screen with the presentation. I don't know if that's going to work well.
We also have your screen up here, but you're welcome to put yours up, and we'll match ours as well. So for the recording.
Okay.
And Mr. Reitfeld, one moment, please. We have a brief at ease. Senate Judiciary is back on the record. Mr. Milan, we've had a request. If you wouldn't mind just letting us do your presentation. The thought is that they like to have this back and forth conversation with you and be able to see you when we're talking to you. So if you would just let us do the presentation, and then I think the other thing is going to be, looks like there's a bit of a lag time between you and us, so we'll just have to like give a little pause of a second or two after someone asks a question to give you a chance to respond or us a chance to respond. Okay?
That sounds good, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much.
All right, well, we are ready for you to proceed, and it looks like maybe the lag time was my, it looks like you were right on the money on that last one. So, yes, once again, please state your name, put yourself on the record, and begin your presentation.
Well, my name is Milan Reitfeld, and do I formally enter myself into the record? Is this sufficient?
That's sufficient.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you and your committee about these very important reforms that are on the agenda in Alaska. This is actually not my first time working with the Alaskan legislature and the administration. I had previously worked with Governor Walker's administration around 2015, 2016. On issues of transitioning towards a historic first-time draw on permanent fund income to support the state budget. So I was involved in legislative testimony at the time and also preceding that, helping the administration think through its own policy on that front. So if we could just go to the next slide, please.
Slide number two is up.
That's correct. So my background, without going into too much detail, I've worked with a number of governments on public sector fiscal reforms, particularly around the management of natural resource revenues, commodity revenues, and particularly on sovereign wealth funds. So my work has taken me to countries as diverse and as far apart as Botswana, Mongolia, I've worked in Alaska, Wyoming, and at the moment I'm also working with a number of Asian countries through the Asian Development Bank. In addition to that, I've worked with pension funds on investment and investment governance issues. We can just go to the next slide, please.
And also, just a little bit of housekeeping. Anyone who might be watching this online, this presentation is available on the Senate Judiciary Committee BASIS website. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Next slide is up.
My work has involved work not only with policymakers and legislators around the world, but also at universities. I've worked at Harvard University, Columbia University, and produced a number of publications, particularly on sovereign wealth funds. Next slide, please. So just to kick us off, to put the really big picture about what are sovereign wealth funds. So this image here is just showing us the commodity-based sovereign wealth funds, which accounts for roughly two-thirds of global sovereign wealth funds. So the Alaska Permanent Fund, very much in that group. That is also the original model of sovereign wealth fund management, that these funds are established to invest a share of proceeds from natural resources rather than have them immediately throw through the budget for spending. But in recent years, there's been also a growth in sovereign wealth funds funded by other forms of public sector revenue and windfall, for example, privatization proceeds in a number of Asian economies, excess foreign exchange reserves. And really, there's been a proliferation of new funds since around the turn of the century. The total global aggregate in assets under management by all sovereign wealth funds is estimated at between $8 and $10 trillion. Naturally, that fluctuates with market valuations, and it's not always clear, particularly amongst a number of Middle Eastern very large funds, exactly how big the portfolios are. The last thing I just want to say on this chart as we set the scene is that the Alaska Permanent Fund really is a major player in the global on the global stage of sovereign wealth funds. Particularly, investment team is very highly regarded. The track record of the fund is really something that a lot of other funds want to learn from, and they always ask, in my particular line of work, they always want to learn more about how the permanent fund was created and all the different iterations of its model that it's gone through. So next slide, please. I think it's worth just emphasizing that what's really happening in Alaska at the moment, and the conversation that's taking place among citizens, amongst the legislature, and amongst the administration, is really something that I see around the world. And so I pulled out here three examples of commodity-producing countries with very large sovereign wealth funds who are essentially having some version of the conversation you're having in the state. So first of all, Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, from the Emirates, has a fund of estimated around $800 billion in assets under management. And they've really been a strong net recipient of commodity and oil revenues. However, they are now in a multi-year discussion that is slowly taking shape about transitioning towards a spending rule that would allow them to not only rely on oil revenues while saving a significant portion of them through the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, but also drawing on the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority's earning potential. And so the configuration is slightly different there. They have a number of sovereign wealth funds, of which ADIA, the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, is by far the largest and most significant. But they are on a very similar sort of thought process as the state of Alaska in this regard. A slightly less positive example, I would say, right now is the Kuwait Investment Authority. Again, very large fund of around $650 to $700 billion that is just now, in the aftermath of the COVID crisis and the collapse in oil prices in 2020, saw very significant drawdowns on one of their two accounts. They have a general fund, and then they have a future generations fund. So the drawdowns occurred on the general fund side, which had implications for the amount that they then saved in the future fund. And really what came to light there is the absence of any kind of formal rule-based framework. It very much relied on custom and consensus and negotiation. And that is essentially broken down this year. So there's been a standoff between the minister and the legislature and the board of the Kuwait Investment Authority, to the extent that there has been no sitting board for 3 or 4 months now. I believe it's just being resolved, but it's perhaps a useful warning of what can happen if you don't have the correct rules in place and well understood by all the stakeholders. Finally, and I will spend a bit more time on Norway. Norway, as everybody might know, has got the largest sovereign wealth fund in the world, now $1.4 trillion in assets under management. And it's still an economy that enjoys an embarrassment of riches, because in addition to the sovereign wealth fund, they generate roughly 3/4 of their revenue from various other sources, sales taxes, income taxes. And so they haven't actually historically had to draw very much on the earnings and the income of their sovereign wealth fund. However, in recent years, that is starting to shift. So with the first time historic draw, if we can maybe go to the next slide, just a couple of headlines here. So in 2009, they made a first time historic use of oil fund earnings. And then they did so again in 2016, so 2 years after that historic oil price collapse in 2014. And then they had record withdrawals in 2020, and then again in this year's budget, another record. And still, as I say, in a very strong position. How their framework works more or less is that they form a budget that completely excludes oil revenues. And then they permit that budget to be in deficit to an amount equal to what they think is the earnings potential on the sovereign wealth fund, which they have very conservatively estimated at 3%, given that that portfolio is more conservatively invested than, say, the permanent fund. That's probably prudent. But so they can run a non-oil deficit equal to the size of 3% of the sovereign wealth fund, which in current terms is roughly $50 billion, and then make a withdrawal of 3% to cover that non-oil deficit. However, in recent years, just this year and the preceding year, the draw has actually been slightly above 3%. So while I think they're still over that around issues of the sovereign wealth fund and the fiscal framework, something's going to give in the coming years, and it would not surprise me if they also have a process of consultation and engagement to formalize their rules, particularly the spending rule.
Mr. Rietveld, a question from Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With the three that you mentioned, Abu Dhabi, Kuwait, and Norway, I was wondering if you knew offhand roughly what the size of the wealth fund was for each of them was compared to the size of their economies.
Through the chair, thank you very much, Senator, for that question. It's a little bit tricky in the case of Kuwait and Abu Dhabi, because we're working off a guesstimate essentially of how big those portfolios are. I remember quite clearly when Juno and the state of Alaska hosted the International Forum of Sovereign Wealth Funds, trying to speak to the delegates from the Middle East to try and get a sense of which of the estimates that I've heard of how big the portfolios are true. And of course, they keep that fairly close to their chest. But if we work on something like $650 billion for the Kuwaiti Investment Authority and around $800 billion for the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, I have sometimes thought about it in terms of how many years of budget cover do they get just on a pure basis, so not taking into consideration which of those funds are accessible, but just pure assets in the sovereign wealth fund versus the average size of the budget in recent years. And I think what you come out to for most Middle Eastern funds is that they have about between 3 to 5 years of cover in the form of the sovereign wealth fund assets compared to an average budget of the past few years. And if you do the same for Norway, I think you come out to around 7 or 8 times budget cover. And depending on exactly which, I mean, the Alaskan budget has clearly moved around quite a bit in the past decade, but if we take an average of it, I think the estimate for Alaska would be roughly 10 to 15 times. I speak under correction about that. But the point that I would make is that just purely on size of budget relative to size of sovereign wealth fund, I believe Alaska has the biggest sovereign wealth fund relative to the size of spending. Now, that's nothing, that's not saying anything about how that is structured and you know, how you can access that fund through the spending rule. It's just a pure sort of rule of thumb number. I hope that that answers the question, Senator.
That work for you, Senator Myers?
That'll work for now. Thank you.
Thanks so much. With no other questions, please resume.
We can go to the next slide, please.
Okay, the comparison with endowments is up.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Mr. Rietveld, a quick question from Senator Hughes.
Yes, I was just, thank you. I was just jotting down notes about what you said about the funds and the cover as far as compared to their budgets. And you said that the in Alaska, our permanent fund has the largest in comparison. And maybe I missed it, but did you say how many years that might cover as you were, as we were comparing those other funds compared to their budgets?
Through the chair, I think it really depends on where we come out to the size of the budget, because as I say, the budget has really increased significantly in Alaska and then has been cut significantly in recent years. But if memory serves, the range that I found was something like 10 to 15 times budget cover. But I do speak under correction. I know that I worked with the Board of Trustees of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation on the publication of a trustee paper in 2020, and we did make a comparison there of the size of the relative size of sovereign wealth funds relative to spending needs, and Alaska clearly came out very favorably in that comparative sense, but don't take my number on the exact number of years of budget coverage as gospel. It's just an indication, I think.
I believe you used the term, it was like the largest per capita for sovereign wealth fund based on the population of the political group that had organized it, whatever, that the Alaska Permanent Fund was the largest per capita.
Through the chair, I mean, I think you could scale it through the size of the GDP, you could scale it through the size of the population or the size of the average spending outlay of government. But in all those comparisons, I think you'll find that Alaska comes out as having a very, very healthy endowment of savings, which I'll come to in a second. It's not the be-all and end-all, because on other metrics, Alaska has vulnerabilities. So a lot of these other economies still have, I think, a more certain near-term outlook for commodity production than the state maybe has. There's more uncertainty around the timing and magnitude of the state's oil production. A lot of these other countries don't quite have to draw onto the fund and start preserving the fund into perpetuity to the same extent that Alaska has. But in any case, that's the basic thought behind those comparisons.
Mr. Chair, just a quick
follow-up from Senator Hughes.
Yeah, I just want to say that thank you. That rough comparison is helpful, and I'll look forward to the rest of what you have to say, but I think it's important when we're looking at these other well-known major funds to realize how Alaska compares. Thank you.
With nothing else from the committee, you're welcome to – oh, I'm sorry, Senator Myers. Oh, Senator Schauer, I'm sorry, I'm not used to looking for you. Senator Schauer, do you have a question?
I'm hard to miss. Thank you, Chair. Just a quick question for him, because we're struggling, obviously. Some of us are in the fiscal working group on our current with the pandemic and COVID, of using some of the funds available to us in the permanent fund to bridge the gap, so-called, to get us there. And while he can't, and I'm not going to ask him for an opinion, I'm just curious – reading some of the highlights, it's hard to tell, but he's involved. Is it true that Norway and perhaps any of the other sovereign wealth funds around the world have used their funds and understanding the nuances of what you just said, they're using some of their funds to help them get through the pandemic. I ask only for context because it's a struggle we're having, how much, if any, we should use. And I would be curious what other countries are using their funds during this time. Is it helping them get through it? It's just a part of the puzzle, but I'd appreciate it if he could maybe just give what he's seen on that, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Through the chair, yes, the answer to that question is very much so. I think the overwhelming majority of sovereign wealth funds have been used in some shape or form to provide fiscal support or direct economic support in some instances. Now, a number of these funds have a portion of their assets or their portfolio that allows them to invest in their domestic economy. I know that's been a long-running conversation in Alaska too. My personal opinion is that the current structure is correct and appropriate for Alaska to not get too involved in state investments, but certainly in the Gulf economies, one way in which the sovereign wealth funds have helped during the COVID pandemic is to shore up local financial markets, whether those are private markets, public markets. So that's been one way. And in the case of Norway specifically, the last 2 years have seen the biggest dollar amount of draw on the sovereign wealth fund for direct budget support, but also the highest percentage on a POMV basis draw that we've seen in the history of that Norwegian fund. So the answer to the question is, Senator, is most certainly yes. Sorry.
No, that's good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to highlight, if that was true, and it sounds like it is, that it is not unusual or perhaps unreasonable for us to look at that as well, as we're struggling with an answer, because I know some legislators do not want to use any of the fund for this. But I think it's interesting to get the context that other countries are helping themselves by using what's available and not borrowing more. I just wanted to put that out as part of the puzzle. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. With no other questions or comments, back to you, Mr. Rietveld.
Mr. Chairman, I also just wanted to say on the comparison that the senator requested, I think there's work that we can certainly do after the hearing to do an analysis that could be quite simple and quite accessible on comparing the major sovereign wealth funds around the world to the size of the budget, the size of the population, the size of the GDP. It could be a useful and quite simple, easy to do side by side that we can certainly work on if requested. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
So to return to the presentation, I think it's also useful not just to compare what's happening amongst sovereign wealth funds, but also a close peer that sovereign wealth funds often get compared to and compare themselves to, which is university endowments, and particularly American, U.S. University endowments. So the first thing that I would just like to kind of emphasize on this table in the chart is that there are really a variety of spending rules being employed by endowments, and they vary. They have a couple of major features. So the one is the spending of income, so realized income on fixed income and paid dividends on equities. And that is really, if we had a table like this from 20, 15 years ago, I think we might have seen that the majority of endowments had a spending policy that worked in that manner. But as you can see in this chart, if you just look on the first column in blue, that roughly, roughly three quarters of university endowments now make use of a POMV methodology. So the simple point is that the POMV approach and framework for thinking about spending on an endowment and indeed on a permanent fund, I think is best practice, and one that I think is definitely much more suitable to the role that the permanent fund is increasingly playing and arguably will continue to play in providing support to the budget. And we can talk about POMV versus earnings again, but personally I'm encouraged to see that the POMV concept has been adopted in the state, because it certainly makes more sense than focusing on realized income only. Next slide, please.
Mr. Chairman.
A question from Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rietveld, on slide six, can you help me with the difference between the average percentage line and the average pre-specified percentage spent line? In most endowment sizes, I'm not seeing significant difference there. In a couple, there is some deviation, including the smallest. How should I understand those two lines to be different?
Through the chair, so there's the spent pre-specified percentage. I think that has to do with the pre-commitment. It has to do a little bit with the timing. When you do POMV calculations, it becomes quite important what time period you use. And so I know in the state there's been an emphasis on a five-year lag moving average, which I think is by far the best way to do it in the context of a state permanent fund. In universities, that gets a little bit more tricky because they argue that the administration of the university and the departments need a sort of longer lead time to do their financial planning, given the leads and lags and spending on university outlays. So they often pre-specify POMV based on an historic value, which can get quite tricky because if your portfolio is fluctuating very dramatically, as it did last year for all endowments and permanent funds, you can look like you're making a massive overspend because the pre-specified amount is now being compared to a smaller portfolio. So that's really the idea there. I think it's much more common to do a sort of moving average five-year, as is the case with the Alaska Permanent Fund now, and indeed the Wyoming Mineral Permanent Trust Fund as well.
A follow-up? Thank you. That's very helpful. I see the only category in which, on average, the pre-specified spend exceeds the average percentage are the smallest funds, the under $25 million endowments. Should we understand that as something particular to schools with small endowments? Should we understand that as an oddity of very small funds? How might we understand that?
Through the chair, I think that's correct. I think that intuition that this is something that these are relatively small amounts. If you have an endowment of $25 million, typical American university, that endowment income will be a very small fraction of their overall income. And I'm going to come to a moment to Harvard, which has, of course, the biggest endowment. And it's a university for which the endowment income and earnings potential is a very significant contributor to the overall revenue sources of the university for operational purposes. So in those cases, specifying the rule in a very, very robust manner is much more important because you can get badly off track. So I think it is, you know, in short, I think the answer is a rule like that is probably a peculiarity of a small endowment where the endowment is not a very significant contributor to revenue.
Thank you.
Any questions?
And a question from Senator Hughes.
Thank you very much. And so I have two questions. First of all, you mentioned that the lag is a better approach, particularly for us, and that some are moving towards that. Are there any that their POMV draw is based on the current balance, or have they all moved to some sort of lag model?
Through the chair, there are POMV models that work based kind of on current value, but really in those cases, so again, Harvard is an example of this. I don't think the POMV calculation is not really the motivating factor for determining how much money to take from the endowment in any given year. They're more interested in a very stable spending path for the university. So they will see if other sources of revenue, such as student enrollment fees and gifts and grants directly to the university, if those are down in a particular year, the objective of the endowment is more to fill that gap. And if those are up in another year, what they then do is they do look back and see how big was the POMV. And they do, so they use it as a backward-looking sense check, if you will, but I don't think that is the driving factor. It's why they'll look at the POMV as one of a number of factors in determining whether they've overspent or underspent, and then if there's a sense that they've overspent, they will sort of try to pull back in subsequent years. And likewise, if they've underspent for a while, they will try to say that there is room to increase the spending rate. So it's a that sort of model is more discretion, and it puts more of an onus on the corporations that run the university. And as we will see in a moment with Harvard, it's not always simple. And I think it's some fairly controversial things took place at Harvard in the past two fiscal years, which we'll come to in a second.
Second question.
And the second question, we see a 4 to 5% range here. Back to Senator Schauer's question regarding the pandemic and perhaps taking out extra, did these percentages average that in, or were some of these taking above what's listed here as their POMV?
Through the chair, survey data that I have seen has suggested that spending rates have gone up in response to the COVID crisis. In some cases, endowments have also pulled back because they saw those market losses in the first half of last year and sort of had a panic approach towards drawing on the endowment. So there's quite a lot of variance, but study that I've cited here at the bottom of this table as the source, that's the sort of gold standard for endowment surveys, the Nakubu study, and that showed that there was an increase in the average spend rate. The average range is found to be between 4 and 5% for endowments, but there are endowments that spend above that. So certainly the trend has been upwards in response to the COVID crisis.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. With no other questions, please proceed.
Next slide. I can't quite see the presentation behind you, but if we're on the slide that's entitled What Happened to Harvard, that's the correct place. So I just want to take a few minutes to talk about Harvard specifically. So the Harvard Endowment is clearly the most famous and the largest endowment in the world, with over $40 billion in assets under management. Their spending rule, as I've mentioned, is not entirely binding. It does leave some room for some wiggle room or some room for discretion. And really the objective is to balance the need for spending stability at the university level. So not really stable spending out of the endowment, but stable spending for the university as a whole. And clearly that's going to be driven quite a lot by non-endowment revenue, which fluctuates quite a lot. As we will see in a moment for 2010 and 2021. But then the second objective is to make sure that whatever you do in the long term, the endowment still is preserved in the first instance and hopefully grows as people contribute to gift and donate to the university. So the general target, in their own words, is a POMV of 5 to 5.5%. But as I said just a moment ago in response to the question, that's really not binding. That is a very long-term consideration that they think they should be spending between 5 and 5.5%, and that is the real earnings potential of the Harvard Endowments portfolio. So if you do that, if you don't exceed your long-term real earnings potential, you're not drawing down on the fund and the long-term intergenerational value of the capital. So within that range, that target range, they have had POMVs as low as 4.2% in 2006, and then a pre-COVID high of 6.1% in 2010. I think we don't quite know yet what the POMV is and has been for the past year, because they're still trying to figure out what the value of the portfolio was and exactly how big the draw will be. But I could well imagine that the 2021 POMV in particular is going to exceed that 6.1%. So it could well be that in hindsight, the 2021 POMV draw will be the biggest in Harvard, certainly in its recent history. So two things that happened in the main in the last two fiscal years at Harvard is that in 2020, 80% of the Harvard endowment is earmarked or restricted for specific purposes. And if we can just quickly cut to the next slide, you'll see here that the first bar shows at the total university level what the revenue sources were for 2020. And you can see that 37% was endowment income, or transfers from the endowment. But as you see then, as you look across the charts, different parts of the university basically receive bigger shares of the endowment income. And that really has to do with benefactors of the universities and donors who sometimes give money to the endowment with a specific purpose that they want it spent at a particular college or in a particular faculty. So if we just go back to the previous slide, please. So what happened in 2020 is that a lot of these funds that were restricted for purposes inside the endowment, the corporation, which is essentially the legislature of Harvard University, agreed to use some of those restricted funds in a general sense, with the approval of some donors and consultation. So that was the first sort of innovation and tweaking of the framework that they conducted in 2020 to meet the challenges of the COVID crisis. And this year, they initially said that the POMV draw in 2021 will be smaller than it was in the previous year. And then they later said that the donations and student fees and other sources of income haven't quite recovered to the level that they expected. And so what they were going to do was increase the dollar spending amount out of the endowment by 1%. And in the final analysis, they agreed on 2.5%. So that is not a jump in the POMV from, say, 5% POMV to 7.5% POMV. It's just the 2.5% growth in the dollar amount that they've drawn. But as I say, I suspect this will be a record POMV, depending on exactly the time frame for managing for assessing the size of the portfolio, which has obviously moved considerably with the collapse in markets at the start of the COVID pandemic and then the very strong recovery in recent months. We can move forward past that slide of the...
Question from Senator Hughes.
Yes, thank you. So in the second last bullet, it says no five-year averaging. So how do they then do their POMV calculation? Is it on the current balance, or how do they do it?
Through the chair, yes. When they speak about the POMV, they've really looked at the most recent fiscal year. But as I say, the POMV is not the rule. The rule is really to have a stable spending path without, in the long run, drawing down on the endowment. But they do report the POMV in their financial reports in a backward-looking sense, just to say how much in the final analysis, if we take the average value of the endowment over that fiscal year, how big was the draw relative to the asset size. And I think on occasions where the value of the portfolio moves a lot, they might then speak. It's more of a communication tool for them, the POMV, than a binding rule. So then they might talk about that there have been sharp fluctuations in the portfolio, so the POMV might need to be applied over a longer time period.
And another question from Senator Hughes.
Well, it's follow-up. So in 2010, when they had the 6.1%, that would be an effective rate because it would be on the balance. And as you do the math on the 5% POMV draw for Alaska at $3.069 billion, that effective rate draw on the current balance is about 3.7 as an effective rate. So if we were comparing apples to apples, am I missing something there, or is there 6.1, would that be an effective rate draw like our 3.7 would be for this year?
Through the chair, yes. As I understand it, that's the right way to think about it. It's an effective draw. What I'm not entirely sure is whether they take it for the value, the end value of the endowment at the end of the fiscal year, or whether they do some kind of averaging, some kind of weighted monthly average over the course of the fiscal year. That is, I'm not entirely sure. Again, we can certainly clarify that if there's a need for that, but that's the way to think about it. It is an effective draw based on the most recent fiscal year.
Yes, Mr. Chair, if we could get that information, if they average the balance through the course of that fiscal year, if they take the end balance. Thank you.
Yes.
And a question from Senator Kuehl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rietveld, after the historic high draw, did the Harvard Corporation then take similarly high draws in subsequent years? Did they make up for that with smaller draws? What is that piece of the history?
Through the chair, what really drives the amount of draw on the Harvard endowment is really how the other sources of revenue are performing as well. So I don't have the history of exactly the PMMVs of the past few years. I just have the record and the record high and the record low there. But what they would do is if they felt that they drew too high on the endowment in one particular fiscal year because other revenue sources were down, they would look to see a recovery in the other revenue sources in subsequent years, which would make it then possible for them to lower the POMV, effective POMV, in subsequent years. But again, we can find the data on what the backward-looking POMVs have been over the past decade, because it would be interesting to see how they balance those out.
Follow-up from Senator Keel.
Mr. Chairman, that would be very helpful information, yes. Thank you. Would lend a lot of insight. I guess the other questions I have would be whether the Harvard Corporation is generally in structural deficit on an annual basis, or whether they generally balance revenues and expenditures on an annual basis, and to whom the decision makers are accountable. How are they appointed or selected? Is that the faculty whose salaries are paid, or the students whose tuition is affected? Who chooses them?
Through the chair, so with respect to the governance decision making, so the authority is called the Harvard Corporation, which is independent of the Harvard Investment Management Company. So the Harvard Corporation is, as I understand it, it's a elected body with stakeholders from the donor community, from faculty, as well as student representatives. But again, the exact composition of that we can clarify as well, because they are the authority that can decide ultimately. Basically the chief financial officer of the university and it's the CEO of the investment corporation deliberate on what is a feasible amount to draw and what is a feasible range, and they report to the corporation, which ultimately then approves it or requests amendments.
So I will repeat this, because I tell you what, I'm a biologist by training. So I don't know how I get into talking about finances in a Judiciary Committee meeting, but so Harvard Corporation, however they choose their managers, they basically look at the needs based on the recent gifts and the recent the productivity of basically their supporters, and they will go to their permanent fund and make their draw, and then they will, after the fact, report the POMV, as I believe you said it was a method of communication as opposed to like a revenue deciding tool. They will report the POMV they drew as opposed to calculating the POMV they're going to draw, correct? I may have
through the chair. Through the chair, I believe I lost you there for a minute for
That's right. The final part of it was they will basically they calculate the POMV that they drew as opposed to reporting the POMV that they're going to draw, correct?
Through the chair, that's exactly correct. I don't think so. I think the best way to describe it is that the POMV is not really the equation that they're solving for. They're solving for spending stability with the constraint that the endowment cannot be depleted in real terms over a 2-3 year period. So for that, they use the POMV in a backward looking capacity to make sure that they haven't overspent. So that's exactly correct in terms of how the decisions get made.
And I don't want to be mistaken as saying that's a good method, because I was making notes earlier on some of your discussions about how some permanent funds rely on custom consensus and negotiation, and I think that's what we here in Alaska have relied on for years, and it's just that's what we're working on right now, is negotiating a resolution to this impasse. My concern, I mentioned it the other day, is that the permanent fund dividend has been a payout to Alaskans of, for the first 20 years, it was bouncing around 4 and 4.5%, and the next 10 years was 3%, next year's 10 years was 2%. No one's corrected me yet, so I think that stands. And now a $1,000 permanent fund dividend is a 1% payout of the percent of market value of the permanent fund. And I'm making the argument that I think it should be more than that. But anybody else? All right. Having gotten off my soapbox, Mr. Rietveld, I believe we are at Alaska in Context.
Correct. I, through the chair, I just want to make two final thoughts about the comparison with Harvard. So the one thing that I would really emphasize is, again, in the corporation's communication about why they ultimately signed off on a 2.5% increase in the draw dollar draw amount for fiscal 21, they explicitly cited exceptionally high financial market returns in the past 6 months. Whatever you think of that argument, I don't have a particularly strong view myself, but I'm just stating that that was how they framed the decision, that it is that it could, that the financial, the CFO and the CEO of the Harvard management company were okay with the draw amount based on exceptionally high investment returns.
And a question from Senator Hughes.
Yes, before we move away from Harvard's endowment fund, you mentioned that it is that endowment draw is the bulk of the revenue they use for operations. Do you happen to know a rough percentage of what that is in a typical year? Not, I know they got extra CARES and PPP funding, but in a typical year,
yeah.
What's the percentage that they're reliant on that draw?
If we can maybe just go to that next graph again, the bar chart, through the chair. So, I mean, in fiscal 2020, you see there it was at the university level, it was 37% of operating budget came from the endowment. So I think that is a relatively high share, given that the other contributors were probably down in 2020. So I think the range would be somewhere between 25% to what you see there, 37. So it's significant, but it's not dominant. The final point that I would want to make about Harvard, and when you think about Harvard versus Alaska or versus any country that, or economy that's got a permanent fund funded by commodity revenues, is that Harvard does see volatility and unpredictability in these other sources of income outside of the endowment, but it's nowhere near as volatile as oil revenues or gas revenues or copper gold revenues. So that's important. And then also there's no reason now to expect that donations to Harvard over the next 20 to 30 to 40, maybe 100 years should decline in real terms. It might, and it might also increase, but they're not confronted with the possibility that maybe one day the source of income completely dries up and that the endowment must be there to take the place of the commodities that were there before it. So those are different ways of thinking about it. But in any case, I still think the comparison is useful for how they think about their spending rates and how they justify changes to it. If there are no further questions, I think we could move on to some more thoughts that I have about the Alaskan situation.
No more questions.
Okay, if we could move on to slide... the first slide that says Alaska in Context, slide 9.
That's where we're at.
All right. So having said all of that, I think it's useful to think about where Alaska sits in this context of global sovereign wealth funds. And really, sovereign wealth funds perform in commodity-based economies, perform some combination of three functions. The one is to be a recipient of savings so that the future generations can enjoy some of the proceeds from natural resource extraction that occur in our generation. They also are a producer of income, so it's one form of asset replacing another form of asset and one revenue stream off the asset replacing another revenue stream off the asset. And finally, they provide fiscal and economic stability, stabilization function. And so the saving function in Alaska has been there from the start through the constitutional certainty, provided that 25% needs to be saved. Although I would say it is somewhat undermined by the structure of the permanent fund, and particularly the existence of the ERA in the current environment, because it is available for appropriation, and as I understand, through a simple majority. So that is not really a savings fund if it's that easily accessible. Now, I know that legislature in Alaska has a history of inflation-proofing out of the ERA, making occasional transfers when the ERA gets too big. But as we stand right now, I think roughly 25% of the permanent fund sits in a structure that is not really a permanent fund. In the true sense of the word, it is available for spending. So that's my only caveat about the savings function, but certainly historically, the constitutional certainty around that has been very helpful. What has really come into focus since 2014 has been the role of the permanent fund as an income producing, as an income source, and as a fiscal stabilizer. So just on that, clearly the income producing potential of the permanent fund has now become well understood and accepted by the majority of citizens and the legislature through the POMB method. But as we all know, and that's what the whole point of this agenda is it still sits on less solid institutional foundations, being outside of the Constitution. That POMV model, the amount of POMV draw can very easily be changed up or down, which is not ideally what you want for a long-term framework to make sure that one function doesn't undermine the other. So very concretely, that the income-producing function of the Sovereign Wealth Fund doesn't undermine the savings that has occurred historically. If I could just draw your attention to that chart on the right, I mean, just visually, what we're really talking about is Alaska sits, if we look at the horizontal axis, Alaska sits with a group of countries and economies that are extremely highly dependent on commodity revenues, so between 80 and 90, sometimes upwards of 90% of revenue coming from oil and gas. So it puts you in the company of Middle Eastern economies and the UAE, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Bahrain. And what you see is that there's a bit of a split between those economies. So in the green bubble, you get countries that are really in quite a bit of trouble if they don't have an oil price of, let's say, $80 a barrel, which is referred to in the literature as a break-even price. So what is the price of oil that you need to balance the fiscal books? And as you can see there, Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, without the ability to draw on sovereign wealth fund income, require an oil price of upwards of $80 to balance the books. And I think Alaska was very much in the same position, given the size of the budget in recent years. However, with the use of permanent fund income, it moves you down to a lower group. And again, don't take that number for the break-even price in the blue bubble for Alaska as the gospel. It's more indicative that with oil prices at, say, $50 a barrel, you could still meet your obligations through the use of permanent fund income. And so that puts you in a group with the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait. An exception to the whole package, of course, is Norway, which gets by with, given its much lower dependence on oil revenues, which is about one third or sometimes lower of all revenues coming from oil, they can get by with a much lower oil price if they need to. The last part that I want to just talk about is the role of the permanent fund and your fiscal framework in terms of providing fiscal stability. So the use of the POMV rule, and specifically the specification of a five-year moving average, does provide significant stability to the state's finances. So that is a fairly stable source of income that helps you avoid fiscal cliffs and fiscal crashes, and also should help you avoid overspending. However, I do think it's helpful for the legislature to think about supplementary measures that might be added to make sure that if there is particularly on the upside, if there is another commodity boom, that surplus revenue, given that you still have 75% of commodity revenues that don't have to go to the permanent fund under current provisions, how could you make sure that that actually does flow to the permanent fund so that if there is another boom, instead of increasing the budget threefold, seeing the majority of those funds flow to the permanent fund? And so one idea is a spending cap, which would limit the amount of spending, and then hopefully the remainder of windfall revenues could go to the permanent fund or to replenish other fiscal buffers. You could also have a rule, which we discussed in the trustee paper 9, where you say if oil prices exceed 80%, we will take whatever percentage of revenues exceeds or comes from the excess of $80 a barrel and put that in the permanent fund. So really on the saving side, I think you could also have a more dynamic rule, and spending caps is one way to get there. Mr. Chairman, I see there's a question.
Thanks so much for that eagle eye, Mr. Rietveld. Senator Schauer, you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it was a question, but he's actually answered it, but I would still like to comment on it. We have for example, when you see the problems we're facing and what we're trying to solve, we've had a Senate Finance Co-Chair currently tell us that we don't have a spending problem, that we just have a cash flow problem, we don't need a spending gap. It's something that, again, three of the five members of this committee have been working tirelessly for the better part of 2 months on solutions that would help us. And our presenter has just, in the last few minutes, highlighted a number of the issues we identified that we believe we need to solve to make this a sustainable problem for us moving forward to actually fix it. So we have that stability. One of those keys being, as he just mentioned, a spending cap. We discussed that at length and how we would do it and how much we could politically get through. But, Mr. Chair, I think it's important because he is literally validating right now a number of the issues that we struggled with to find, a path forward that would put Alaska on a sustainable and stable path. And it highlights the problem we face politically. When you think about what some of our, folks, how they approach this. But I got to tell you, it is encouraging to hear this because I believe it is very important that the people hear and understand that, we need these certain structural certainties moving forward as much as we need constitutionalization of certain things for certainty. But this is very refreshing to hear. And I would love, perhaps Senator Keeler Hughes might have a comment on that, but this is fascinating. This is right up the alley of things we have been discussing for 6 or 7 weeks. Thank you.
Senator Hughes.
Thank you. And just maybe saying it just slightly differently, but in agreement with Senator Schauer, some have proposed that the POMV draw itself is a spending cap. But as our presenter pointed out, if we would have a boom in an area and we end up with extra revenue, the POMV does not serve as the kind of cap that has been mentioned. So it is important that when there aren't booms, the POMV certainly can function that way. But what we need to make sure is if we ever have an uptick and a boom, that we don't get back into the situation that happened earlier in the 2000s.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Any other comments from the committee? Seeing none, Mr. Rietveld, when you're ready to pick up on Alaska in context.
Through the chair, I just want to add some thoughts around what was just said. So, the POMV acts as a spending cap, but only to the part of the system that pertains to the permanent fund. So it's a cap on the amount that you might over the long term spend in the permanent fund, but still 3/4 of your windfall revenues are going to go other places unless you find a mechanism. And I think it needs to be a mechanism that you have some kind of statute or even constitutional language that says above a certain percentage, and there's so many different ways you could specify that, that the share of the excess and a significant share of the excess should go to the permanent fund. And what that allows you to do is it does allow you to increase spending, but at a much more gradual rate. And in fact, what it will help you do is increase the level of spending permanently, but that would also be sustainably, as opposed to just moving along with the commodity cycle up and down, which is not a unique Alaska's history. It's an ailment that afflicts most commodity-dependent economies, and sovereign wealth funds and the fiscal rule around a sovereign wealth fund is one way to address that.
Thank you.
Next slide, please. So some of what I just said is basically on this slide, but it's maybe worth repeating. So in that trustee paper from last year, volume 9, we had this table that you see on the right here, which is really a comparison of between Alaska, Wyoming, Kuwait, the Canadian province of Alberta,
Mr. Reedfeld,
and Saudi Arabia.
I just want to confirm, on your account, are we on slide 10 or 11 right now?
We are on slide 10, sorry.
Okay, I'm sorry. Slide 10. Thank you.
This table is a sort of subjective scoring, but we thought long and hard about it, about the relative strengths and weaknesses of different comparator economies. And I'm happy to go through it in detail, but I've basically done a summary here of what I, from the outside, consider to be Alaska's advantages over peers and also some of its weaknesses and vulnerabilities. So on the advantages side, there is this constitutional clarity around the 25% of revenues that must be saved through the permanent fund. And there is a history of savings, is a history of doing the right things, sometimes eventually, if not immediately, things like inflation proofing the corpus, expropriating very large balances in the ERA into the corpus. So that is there, and that is not a small thing. A lot of countries with sovereign wealth funds struggle to stick to their best intentions on the saving side. So I do think the fact that you sit here today with an $80 billion fund is a testament to that history of savings. And it very much comes from the constitutional language. It's a sort of aside to the fiscal framework, but you also are blessed with a really talented and very highly regarded investment management team at the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. And sort of part of that is that the Board of Trustees have designed an asset allocation, so a amount of risk bearing capacity that the portfolio has that's really appropriate to what you want the permanent fund to do for you. So those are, again, significant advantages. These are things that are actually quite problematic in a number of other countries, and that's actually what I spend a lot of my own personal time in, is on fixing investment capacity and asset allocation. So there's no need for that in the Alaskan context right now. That said, there are weaknesses and vulnerabilities compared to even some of your commodity-dependent sovereign wealth fund economies. So very high dependence on oil revenues as it stands at the moment, particularly if you take out the permanent fund component, whereas economies like Wyoming are also dependent. It's of a lesser magnitude given their that they have sales taxes and other sources of income. And Norway certainly is a very large oil producer, but still has recourse to many other sources of revenue. So on that comparative basis, Alaska is very, very dependent on oil, sort of in the leagues of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. And with that, as it does for all commodity producers, is an uncertain long-term outlook for commodity production, which I'm not trying to say that it's the end of the oil and gas era in Alaska, but I literally mean it is uncertain. And it's uncertain the timing of those production potentials and how that would all play out. And the very, very long term, it's uncertain how climate change and climate change policies might affect the viability of all producers of fossil fuels. Another weakness, as we've just discussed, is the lack of constitutional certainty around the spending rule. So it has now been adopted as a PMV through statute in the legislature in the past few years. But I believe that the intention to put that in constitutional language is very valuable. And specifically the ERA that sits there, it's really a legacy of a model that was framed in terms of realized investment income, which had to do with the way the dividend was funded and the old formula. If you've now moved to a POMV model and you've adopted the mindset that the permanent fund is a permanent source of income to the budget, the ERA is really a piece of legacy architecture that creates not only political risk, but also financial risk. So there, in the trustee paper number 9, we also considered what you might do if the ERA, as implausible as it seems right now at $20 billion, if it ever got depleted through a series of financial market events, and how would you actually make sure that there is money available to fund the BOMB draw? So I think the idea to roll it into one sovereign wealth fund portfolio and find a way to finance the BOMB is a much more suitable and fit for purpose set of arrangements. So the final thing is just what we concluded on the previous slide, and that's really thinking about what can be done, not just on the spending side, but on the saving sides, if there is another boom or another windfall upside, to make sure that that boom bust cycle in the budget and in the government spending, that you don't fall victim to that again, but that a bigger share of the boom and the windfall goes to the permanent fund to raise the level of spending on a more sustainable permanent basis rather than temporarily. If we can move to slide 11, please. So this paper that I've mentioned, Trustee Paper Volume 9, was titled The Role of Sovereign Wealth Funds in Saving, Stabilization, and Generating Income. So in the title, you already see the three functions that I keep coming back to. And what we did in that study was to look at some peers, and we focused particularly on big commodity producing economies, commodity-dependent economies. But we limited the focus to accountable democratic systems because there's just so much we can say about sovereign wealth funds in the Middle East. It clearly operates on a different principle. But if we compare Alaska to peer economies, we found Alberta, Wyoming, New Mexico, Texas, Norway, and Chile. And we really looked at what worked in some instances, and we also looked at what didn't work. And so if we go to slide 12 and 13, 12 first, I'll just conclude with kind of the five key messages from that analysis that's contained in the paper. And they start off quite general, and they'll become more specific to the Alaskan context. So the first lesson is what we called mission clarity. And that sounds kind of fairly simple and kind of fairly obvious, but you would be surprised how many sovereign wealth funds, there is just no general consensus about what the purpose of the sovereign wealth fund is. So some people think the sovereign wealth fund is there to save. Other people think the sovereign wealth fund is there to support the budget in times of crisis. Other people think that the sovereign wealth fund is there to invest in the domestic economy, to catalyze new industries and help the economy diversify. So I think that is not the case in Alaska. Alaska does have mission clarity, as do all the other successful funds in our study, Norway, Wyoming, Chile. And the only thing that I would say about mission clarity is that the mission has shifted from purely savings towards a multitude of functions, which include savings, but also income generation and fiscal stability. So I think those are increasingly important functions, those last two, but I feel like it's well understood, and it's a consensus idea now in Alaska that the mission has shifted somewhat. And I guess the key question now is, not given that shift has taken place, the importance and value of now shoring it up in constitutional language, I think, is quite significant. The second general lessons is that rules really help, and they really matter. So it's very clear that systems that rely, Mr. Chairman, there you'll see your phrase again there, custom, discretion, negotiation, it only gets you so far, but in the long run, it's clearly led to inferior outcomes. It's hard for the system to adhere to its saving policies in boom times, and it's hard not to draw down too heavily in tough times unless you have a rule-based framework. So rules really help, and they de-escalate the tough decisions. If you can fall back on rules, you just take a lot of contentious issues off the table and make sure that you're consistent if your rule is correctly specified over the commodity cycle. And so once again, I think the inclusion of rules for the spending side of the Alaska Permanent Fund equation in constitutional language is a very good way to do it, which brings me really to the third point, and that is, if you have rules, how do you enforce them? And in the study, we looked particularly at some U.S. permanent funds where the rules that were there in concept really relied on statutory provisions, and we often then saw departures from the rule, whereas we know that Wyoming and Alaska have succeeded in sticking to the rules that are enshrined in the Constitution. So again, constitutional language is very valuable. The exception to that perhaps is Norway, which has always relied on a consensus model. But as I said in the section on Norway, I actually believe it's the pressure is building, and I would not be surprised at all if there's some impetus to firm up the rules, and perhaps also in constitutional language. If we can go to slide 13. So this paper was written as the POMV concept was still sort of taking shape, and so some of this you know already, but you've acted on it. But it's we did believe that the POMV rule is best practice and best is fit for purpose as a technical way to formulate the rule for Alaska, and it just what it brings with it is just a shift in focus away from realized earnings to the total return concept. Moving averaging is essential, I think, in an economy that's as volatile as Alaska's, and a portfolio that is appropriately risk oriented is going to experience significant fluctuation. So having a five-year moving average lagged is certainly the best way to smooth some of that volatility in the spending rule side. And then, of course, in the long run, it's just important to make sure that, and it really applies to the long run, Mr. Chairman, as we discussed in relation to Harvard, the POMV concept is really, for them, a sense check about the level of spending over a long horizon. And the point is that your POMV rate in the long run needs to match what your portfolio is returning in nominal terms minus inflation and the cost of managing the portfolio. Otherwise, you are de facto eating into the portfolio in the long run. And I think POMV rates it's really best to think about POMV rates in a long run concept, because you can do the math on it, but essentially, if you make a mistake on the POMV of overspending by 0.5% for a decade on a compound basis, that is much more devastating to the real value of your portfolio than, for example, the short-term overspend in a particular a set of circumstances followed by a commitment to a more sustainable level of spending. So if you compare the two, it's really important to get the long-run spend rate right. And again, there, I think the constitutional language is the best way to ensure that. Just the final point is on the point of the ERA. So the ERA principal split, as it constituted at the moment, does both political risks. It does risk frequent annual standoffs about how much money to spend out of the ERA, and always a perennial risk that all of the ERA could, in theory, be appropriated. And that would be very detrimental to the long-term sustainability of the Alaskan system. But it also creates financial risk. So it does create the possibility that under a particular set of market circumstances, you could draw down on the ERA and deplete it, and then you'd have a problem of how to fund the POMV on a purely cash flow basis. And what that then means is that I can understand that the legislature might be reluctant to move parts of the ERA over to the corpus, which would be on its own the prudent thing to do. But they then might be worried about whether there's enough coverage in the ERA to fund a POMV under stressed market circumstances. So it's more important that the portfolio is appropriately allocated to risk. And it's more important that is more important than maintaining the ERA. So In the trustee paper, we considered a number of ways that if the ERA would still be there, how you could develop a number of supplementary rules, like a coverage ratio for the ERA relative to the last 2 or 3 years of budget spending. But really, if the option on the, is on the table to roll the ERA and the corpus into one sovereign wealth fund portfolio, I think that is much more desirable than trying to retrofit a piece of legacy plumbing, frankly, that's not really required and suitable to a PMV type spending rule. Mr. Chairman, I've come to my final slide, but if there are any questions, I'm happy to discuss what I've just gone through.
Senator Hughes.
Thank you. Now, you mentioned rolling the ERA into the corpus would be a good thing and ultimately a way to protect it. And one of the things we're facing right now is in different than probably most permanent fund type funds around the world or endowment funds is that we need voter approval. So there's a political element that enters. One of my concerns is knowing that we've been struggling with this for 6 years is to be able to, first of all, be able to pay what the people would consider fair and reasonable in the permanent fund dividend in order that they would then approve the constitutional amendment rolling the ERA into the corpus. But in order to do that, we would have to draw an additional percent and a half above the 5%, which I think becomes about a 5% effective rate draw on the current balance. But there's concern that what would happen if the constitutional amendment would fail, then we've set a precedent of going above the 5%. And that's a very valid concern. So one of the ideas was that if the constitutional amendment would fail, and I would hope it wouldn't be because we'd be back in the fiscal chaos we've been in the last 6 years and back at square one. One of the ideas is if it failed, we could have a trigger in the statute that we would drop the POMV rate to 4% or 4.5% to try to build up from taking it out. Of course, because of the court case, and I know you're familiar with that, our statutes are guidelines, and that's why we need the constitutional component. But I guess I would ask you, as someone who is very knowledgeable about these funds, do you think the trade-off to try to get a constitutional amendment by taking out an additional percentage or so draw in order to pay a decent permanent fund dividend to the people of Alaska to get their support for a constitutional amendment, is that a good trade-off in your mind, or is that risky?
Through the chair, I would defer on matters of political judgment about how to get it done. But what I would say in general terms is a number of things. So the one is that people are hurting after the COVID crisis. So this would be some small form of sort of like a fiscal stimulus support to households. So in it, there is a certain kind of economic logic to it. In terms of the politics of it and how that plays out, I can't really comment. But I do see in very general terms the need for people to feel that they are part of this reform process. So even beyond, in the constitutional language, something like the 50-50 split could be a good way for people to feel like they are still stakeholders in how the permanent fund performs. So, to your specific question about sort of something like a course correction if the constitutional amendment did fail, that sounds to me like the kind of thing that you would then seriously have to look at. The whole point is to get the system onto a sustainable 5% locked in sort of footing. But if failing that, you want to make sure that that there is an even stronger reaction then towards sustainability in subsequent years. So I can see the logic of that, and it's the kind of thing that I think it came up in reference to Harvard. If Harvard's had a couple of years of bigger draws, do they correct with a sort of underspend for a period of time. And I think that does happen. But of course, they also look then, you as the state would also then have to look in next fiscal year, how do your non-permanent fund revenues look? And the need to maintain kind of fiscal stability and not withdraw as a sudden shock the amount of activity that the government puts into the Alaskan economy. You need to do that very tricky balancing act. So I fully appreciate this is not a politically and economically not an easy thing to get right, but I have absolutely no qualms about what is in the proposed constitution amendment. As policies, I think they are very sound.
Senator Keel, and then after that would be Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess, Mr. Rietveld, does that response go to why your paper for the trustees limited the comparison to accountable democracies, right? I mean, the Harvard example, those overseers are elected exclusively by the alumni, right? So they're not accountable to the faculty and staff who draw their salaries. They're not accountable to students who pay their tuition. It's only the donor class. So there's a reasonable likelihood they're not going to eat the endowment, as opposed to the dilemma that Senator Hughes just, I think, fairly ably described. We don't know for sure that we can count on future legislatures. Am I understanding correctly why your limitations were to accountable democracies, or are there other factors that we should be thinking about too?
Through the chair, that certainly is part of the reason why we were not particularly interested in looking at how non-democratic authoritarian governments you handle their affairs. But the other thing that you just find with non-democratic systems is a lot of unpredictability. And it's not true in all cases. I think Abu Dhabi has really stayed the course in their strategy, but the Saudi fund has gone through massive fluctuations. And even in the course of the last 3 years, this sort of, you know, to the point of mission clarity, it's not clear to me whether the Saudi fund is primarily a fiscal stabilization fund, a savings fund, or a sort of like a domestic development bank. So those are all factors that limited why we wanted to look at democratic systems. The very practical point, too, is that in the democratic systems, we have the documented history, so we could go back and look at exactly what happened in New Mexico, what happened in Wyoming, which we just can't do in systems that aren't as transparent and don't disclose as much. The one general point that I would say about all of this is that it is clear that passing reforms are obviously not easy, and passing good reforms in particular, it seems to be very hard. And I think there have been moments where permanent funds and the legislators and administrators of these systems have thought about how they can basically sell good long-run ideas to constituents. And so I think I know there is a disputed history on how the permanent fund dividend itself came about, but that in itself was a mechanism to get constituents and the citizens of Alaska to feel like they have a stake in the permanent fund, rather than something that was done out of purely financial reasons or economic reasons. So there is a history of that, and I think, I'll leave it at that.
Just a follow-up.
Follow-up from Senator Keel.
Since we're in judiciary, I would only also note that if they don't get back on track after an occasional extra draw, the overseers of Harvard have a fiduciary duty they might be in breach of, but you can't sue legislators or princes for that.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I feel like our presenter might have was watching us in our struggling fiscal plan working group as we looked at solutions, and if he wasn't, he should have been. Based on many of his comments, it's fascinating to note that many of the things he's saying, again, I think it's very important people need to hear this. He's lining right up with the solutions we said, stable, sustainable, moving forward. One of the things we all struggle with is a constitutional any kind of cracking the Constitution open, right, for some of these things. But I'm watching his brief and listening to him talking over and over. He's saying constitutional protection, constitutional protection. That's the certainty that even though I know many of us are reticent to know we have to crack open the Constitution, how else do we get there? And I am fascinated that the conclusions they reach are quite honestly very much in line with the conclusions they very diverse from liberal to conservative, Democrat, Republican working group just came up with. My question to him would be, Mr. Chair, earlier he mentioned that, you know, for the long-term more stable, if you will, there's other sources of revenue, like talk Norway. They have a lot of revenue options. What does he think if, and this is where, if he hasn't seen our working group result, I wish he would have or could, because we agree that, you know, one thing isn't going to solve it. We can't just have the PFD changed. We can't just have taxes. We need multiple things. And balancing the budget is going to take that. If he was to understand from our suggestion that we would have a more balanced budget by having other tax sources, say many of the changes we talked about, maybe a sales tax or corporate taxes and other things, and if we did that, so we weren't as reliant on the fluctuation in oil prices, we had sustainability or stability with the PFD if we were to constitutionalize this moving forward and had other revenue streams, would that fit the mold that would therefore he would be more comfortable in his lane of expertise knowing that we had that moving forward? Does that make sense as a question? I just wanted to get his read on that for what we're suggesting we need to do.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Mr. Rietveld?
Through the chair, yeah, the question is perfectly clear. I haven't had a deep look at the numbers, but I have some sense of how much juice you could squeeze out of the lemon of the permanent fund, so to speak. And it's clear to me that there is no way to draw on the permanent fund only. And solve what needs to be solved here, so that it really has to be a comprehensive package of measures, which probably includes revenue-raising measures and cost-cutting measures. But you definitely are fooling constituents or yourself if anybody thinks that the permanent fund and PMV itself can take care of what needs to happen on its own. So strongly think that the permanent fund, both for a solution to the near-term issues, but also for the future of the state, I think there's only so much you can do with permanent fund earnings, notwithstanding the fact that you have a very big sovereign wealth fund. If the permanent fund was $150 billion, which, mind you, it could have been if you had a prudent savings, if you had a sort of supplementary savings rule through the last oil price boom, you might have had $150 billion permanent fund. If you had that, the permanent fund could probably solve a lot, sort of all the problems. But that's not, unfortunately, the case now. So I think then you get into technical details about sales tax versus income tax, corporate tax, and those have distributionary consequences and who they affect and under different measures. But from a revenue raising perspective, I think they would have to be part of the solution. But I'm not an overall expert on Alaska's overall fiscal situation, but it is clear to me that the permanent fund alone can't solve the problem.
Excellent. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And a question or comment from Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Dr. Rietveld, we've talked a lot in this presentation about stability. What I've noticed, though, is that it's a relatively narrow area that is being affected by the stability. It's effectively stability for government revenues, and then hence government spending. What I'd like to hear your comments on is having sovereign wealth funds and how that does or does not create stability regarding the rest of the economy. Because what I'm very concerned about here is we're going to put ourselves on a path moving forward where we've got a relatively stable government with a stable source of revenues. And if the stock market continues to do what it's done, a growing source of revenues with a very volatile and perhaps even anemic rest of the economy within the state?
Through the chair, I think there is an inevitability to volatility in the Alaskan economy. So the best is to think about policies and institutions that can help you manage that volatility. And I think the first point that I would say is that fiscal policy, government spending in Alaska, up till perhaps most recently, has been a contributor to volatility, or has been an exacerbator of volatility. So spending has risen when revenues have risen and when oil prices have risen, and has been cut when oil prices collapsed and revenues collapsed and jobs were under pressure. So it's a sort of the first principle is do no harm through fiscal policy, and that there's still work to be done there to ensure that happens. The second point I would say is that particularly for lower income Alaskans, the permanent fund dividend is clearly an important part of their welfare, and having a dividend which is a bit more predictable and stable, which I think the proposed constitution amendment would achieve, is helpful as well. That you don't get dividends that fluctuate wildly and are unpredictable. But again, it's a little bit like the contribution that the permanent fund can make to your fiscal problem. The contribution that the permanent fund can make to the management of your overall economic volatility is limited. But I think, as a first principle, ensuring that fiscal policy doesn't exacerbate the enormous amount of volatility that the Alaskan economy is inherently exposed to is quite important. But it's certainly a very valid observation that Alaska is a very volatile economy.
All right. Thank you, Senator Myers and Dr. Rietveld. You know, I'll just make a few final comments. $82 billion, no one really thought the permanent fund would be there at this point. But, you know, there's a couple indicators on how this happened. We did take out a $14.5 billion loan out of the CBR a couple of years ago that we chose not to repay. And there's a lot of people who would argue that we haven't been following the statutory, even the percent of market value 5.0/50/50 plan, and there's probably another $7 billion there. I don't know that we can look forward to as much productivity from here forward over $82 billion unless we take out another $14.5 billion loan every 30 years that we don't pay back. But I do believe it's important that we get it right, and I think we're narrowing down, figuring, you get in the target zone right there. I will just say, Dr. Rietveld, you have slide 14. Was there any more comments that you wanted to make before we end this meeting?
Mr. Chairman, the slide 14 is just a summary of my key messages, so I'm happy to go through them and conclude my thoughts on it. But if there are further comments at this stage, there's not going to be anything new on slide 14 that we haven't discussed yet. It would just be a summation. So I'm happy to take a question.
One final question for me. Do you see some value to at least making a partial payment back to the CBR to give us some liquidity, especially if we get rid of the earnings reserve account?
Mr. Chairman, to be honest, I need to think about that a little bit. I'm not entirely familiar of the merits of having money in the CBR versus in the ERA. What I do know is that that was a source of liquidity, and that was sort of like a rainy day fund for the state that has been depleted. So in my comments, for example, if there is a recovery in revenue, I spoke very much about putting that money into the permanent fund, some percentage of the windfall. And that would be, I think, my preference. But one option could also be to replenish some of those the CBR and other rainy day funds, so that it's all a way of avoiding an unscheduled and unsustainable amount of draw on the permanent fund further down the road. So there are merits to refilling the buffer funds as well.
Thanks so much, sure. Senator Hughes.
Yes, thank you, and really appreciate you being here and providing your expertise and insight. But I just want to point out to members and to the public that are viewing the documents, the last bullet on this page, you spoke a little bit about it, but just what we're working on currently in this committee is SB 53, which would make some changes to the statute that would link up with a constitutional amendment. And part of it is bearing in mind the need for the bridge period. So I just want people to notice that bullet. It should be comprehensive, all available options on the table, one-time higher draws do happen. Key is having a credible commitment mechanism to sustainably and rule-based constraints. So I believe that's what this committee is working towards with SB 53, Mr. Chair, so I thought I'd point that out.
Thank you, Senator Hughes, for pointing that out. With nothing else from the committee, thank you, Dr. Rietveld, for this great presentation today. And I understand that you and Senator Shire are both on opposite sides of the world from us. Appreciate you making yourself available at whatever awkward time of day it is for you and Senator Shire. Also, thank you to the committee members for their flexibility. We are in a special session under the 24-hour rule. We will be holding our next meeting tomorrow, August 31st at 1:30 p.m. to finish our work on SB 53. Is there any other business before the committee? And seeing none, the committee is adjourned at 12:05. Thank you.